I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
We're joined in the studio here by Dr. Craig Stephen Wilder. He's the author of this incredible new book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of American Universities. He's a professor of history at MIT. And his previous books include A Covenant with Color and In the Company of Black Men. Craig Stephen Wilder, good to have you in the studio. Welcome. Good to meet you, man.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Pleasure. Let's backtrack a minute. I mean, I was thinking about what we talked about and how we ended our conversation in December. I think about December 14th when we talked by phone. And I just harken back to the beginnings of the book when you describe how the slave trade and the slave ship, the Divine, was it?
Yeah.
1636.
Desire.
Desire, excuse me. Desire.
1638.
1638, I'm sorry. Yeah. I knew you had the date better than I.
I remembered a few things.
That's good. How that was connected to the founding of Harvard University. It started in 1636. And it sort of is the underpinning of how the North, the slave trade, the West Indies were all intertwined. Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's a brilliant moment for really thinking about how New England comes together, how the British colonies come together, and how these relationships between colonialism, the conquest of native nations, the slave trade, and the academy ultimately actually get intertwined, they get braided. And so early in the research process, I was sort of looking at the origins of Harvard. And what happens is the college is founded in 1636. The Pequot War breaks out the very next year. The Puritans are fighting against the Indians of southern Connecticut. And much of this is driven by Puritan expansionism, by the rapid growth of the Puritan population and the quest for land. The Pequot are defeated. The war is actually often referred to as the Pequot Massacre. The captives, mostly women and children, Pequot captives, are actually put on a ship named the Desire, and they're sent to be sold into Bermuda in the West Indies. The Desire returns in 1638, carrying various goods, commodities, including enslaved Africans. And that very year, Harvard, the primary instructor of Harvard, Nathaniel Eaton, has a man named the Moor,
right,
a black slave who's actually working for him on campus. He's the only instructor. He's basically the president and effectively the president and the professor,
right,
of early Harvard, a rough institution to say the least. But the Moor actually then becomes part of Harvard legend. Yeah, you know, he sort of gets he shows up in different places. There's some records of him. You know, the well-known Harvard historian Samuel Eliot Morrison, who recorded much of Harvard's history during his long career in the 20th century, wrote actually quite frequently about the Moor. He referenced him quite frequently. But what tended to happen when, especially at northern colleges, when historians confronted the presence of enslaved people on college campuses like the Moor, the tendency was to sort of treat them as fantastic, grotesque, flawed characters, drunkards, immoral. And by doing that, erase the problem of the moral problem of their presence on campus. And so to the extent that they could be caricatured and lampooned, they didn't need to be explained. And so what happens with the Moor is what I attempted to do with him is to do a bit more of explaining how and why he got there and how his presence actually is a wonderful way of understanding how the rise of Harvard, the rise of the academy in colonial British America, was intimately tied to both native conquest and the African slave trade. All of these things come together in that moment. And it's exactly what brings him to this early campus that's now Harvard. And the Harvard that we think of today is not the one we should be thinking of in the 17th century. They bear very little resemblance to each other.
But the growth of Harvard, the growth of Yale, the growth of what became Princeton, the growth of Penn, the growth of all these colleges that you outline in the book, the exponential growth over those next 50 to 100 years was funded, founded, and because of both the enslavement of Native people, but more importantly, this enslavement of Africans.
I had a struggle as I was doing the research. It was an 11-year project for me, and I had a struggle as I was doing it to explain something that actually Samuel Johnson, the Reverend Samuel Johnson, was the president, the founding president of King's College, which is now Columbia in Manhattan. And at one point in time, he had a very bad relationship to his trustees, who were largely merchants and many of them slave traders. And the relationship got increasingly sour to a point where Johnson once wrote to his son and just referenced the stupidity of the trustees. The letter is actually still there in Columbia's archives. It's one of those great moments for a historian when you sort of come across that. you know, we actually at college faculty would like to say that from time to time. But yeah, he says it. But what he's talking about is actually they had these fantastic fundraising schemes. They were sending people all over Europe. They were sending people to West Indies to raise money. And right out of the letter comes this line: what is the need for so much money? What's the need for so many tutors when we don't have any students? Right? And so they're raising money constantly, but in fact there are no students. And it's that question that actually sort of forced me to rethink the early part of the book. Mm-hmm. Because in fact, actually, why did Harvard need so much money? Why did William and Mary in 1693, when it's founded, why was it looking for so much money in Europe and in the West Indies? These are really quite small local colleges. They're lucky if they have a building. A 20th century historian of higher education put it quite nicely. I'm going to paraphrase him. You know, if a colonial college had a building, then it didn't have a president. If it had a president, then it had no money. If it had money, it didn't have a building. If it had a building and money, it didn't have trustees and it had no students. These are all struggling institutions. They're tiny and they're local. And so what was the need for all this? And that's where I actually started to look at the relationship between the colleges and Native Americans, which is actually in some ways explains why it was that the colleges worked so aggressively to tap into the wealth being created by the slave trade and slavery. The college is an instrument in the colonial world. It's there to do specific kinds of work. And part of its real challenge, part of its mission, is to help subdue native nations and to bring them under the governance of European powers.
So let me just very quickly talk about that. And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. We have about 20 or so minutes in this conversation left, and I want you to be part of it because it's a very important book. You can also meet Stephen Wilder tonight at Red Emmett at 7:30. But this is an important point. Let's be more specific about how the early college system was part of the oppression of Native Americans. Yeah. Then I want to talk about the slave trade connection even more deeply.
Sure. In New England, in New France, Eastern Canada, the French colonies in Eastern Canada, New Spain, the vast Spanish colonies from the Caribbean, the Spanish Caribbean, Mexico south to Colombia and Peru. In each of these regions, colleges were established almost immediately. The very first college in the Americas, 100 years before Harvard, in 1536, is established in Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. It's still there. It's the Autonomous University. It's the oldest college in the
West Hemisphere.
And, you know, in each place, for the Catholic priest in the Caribbean and in Mexico, for Puritans and Anglicans in the British colonies, and for French Catholic priests in Eastern Canada, building a college was part of the structure for sending out missionaries into Native nations, bringing in Native youth in particular, training them in Orthodox Christianity, whatever the definition of the denomination was, and then sending them back as ambassadors of the faith. The college was an instrument for waging a kind of culture war against Native nations, and that was part of their project. And that's a sort of direct way of putting it. But in fact, actually, I think that's proven out by British history or in English history in the century before the English arrive in the Americas. They do something very similar in Scotland and Ireland. They begin, in fact, funding, the crown begins funding actually quite handsomely. Colleges, professorships, universities, in order to establish religious orthodoxy, extend the reach of the church, and bring people under the sway of the English government to make colonialism real in day-to-day practice.
That'd be interesting if you could expand. I don't want to do that now because we have too much to talk about, but expand that to extrapolate that out to look at America today in terms of what our schools are doing with high-stakes testing and how that is tied in some similar ways to that same philosophy of colonialism and where it came from. I mean, I think there's a direct
Well, the idea certainly of weaponizing education.
Right.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
And the other thing I think, just for people to get a broad sense here to come see you tonight, is that this connection between the West Indies and the funding and expansion of our earliest colleges, and to ensure that kind of in some way one aspect of it, ensuring the children of slaveholders had places to go in this hemisphere that were funded by their own merchants that were dealing in slaves, was part of this process, and that the there's also part of the intellectual underpinning to justify the notions of racism and slavery.
Yeah, the book is
all intertwined.
They're all intertwined. And the book is divided into two parts. And the first part is I attempt to explain the relationship between colleges and slavery, how colleges actually got so many enslaved people on their campuses. And I'll just give an example.
Yeah.
Eliezer Wheelock, the founder of Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, arrives in New Hampshire to build his college with 8 enslaved people, 7 adults and a child, an infant child. And if you do the math on that, that means he actually has more slaves than faculty. He's got more slaves than active trustees. He's actually got more slaves than students, if you do an honest counting of it. The largest population of people on early Dartmouth were, in fact, the enslaved people who were building his campus for him. And so the first part of the book really was an attempt to explain why it was that at the College of Rhode Island, which is now Brown, there's so many slave traders on the board. Why it is at Columbia, which was then King's College, the sons of slave traders, the sons of the merchants, dominated the undergraduate classes, and why it was that there were enslaved people on these campuses and at times actually even building these campuses. The second part of the book, I attempt to explain what the intellectual consequence of that was, the legacy that lives with us even today. And part of it is that slavery embedded in these institutions transforms the way that we think about the world, and certainly transforms the way that 18th and 19th century intellectuals engaged the world. One of the places you can see that is in the rise of the sciences in the colonial world. And what I did in that part of the book is I traced the students. I just followed them. They went from places like Virginia and Philadelphia and New York, graduates of these early colonial colleges. They went from Jamaica and Barbados, the wealthy sons of planters and slave traders, Caribbean and southern planters and northern slave traders. And they went to Europe to study science. They went to Europe to study medicine after college, to places like Scotland. In particular, the Americans liked Scotland. But they did go to France. They went to Holland, sometimes to England. And they emerge on the other side of the Atlantic as experts on race relations. They have intimate relationships with Native Americans and Africans. If you think about Thomas Jefferson's Notes on Virginia, where he speculates broadly on the biological, intellectual, and cultural capacities of Native Americans and Africans. Jefferson is someone who had throughout his entire life, from his childhood through his adulthood, close contact with Native Americans and Africans. When he was a student at William & Mary, about 10% of the undergraduate population was actually still Native Americans in the early 1760s. And so his speculations actually have an air of authority about them. And like many American of the American students who go to Europe for their education, Jefferson doesn't. They arrive in Europe with assigned a kind of authority over Native Americans and Africans. They begin to actually give lectures on them, lectures on the course of disease among African people, on the prevalence of albinism among Native Americans. They also write dissertations, often on these kinds of topics. They then come back to establish their very first medical schools. And that means that, Samuel Bard, the son of John Bard, a New York surgeon who, graduates from the American colleges, heads off to Edinburgh to study medicine, comes back to establish the second medical school in North America, the one at Columbia. The first is at Penn. While Bard is actually studying in Scotland, his father is buying a large farm on the Hudson River in New York, purchasing slaves and an overseer. When Samuel comes back, he establishes the medical school. He also, using some of the family money, but he also, in fact, marries the daughter of one of the leading slave traders of New York, the Kruger family. And that becomes, in fact, part of the foundation for this sort of new institution. Yeah, and so what I argue in that part of the book is that the very way that we think about the world gets transformed by these relationships, because ultimately what happens to science is science gets placed under the governance of slave traders and slave owners as it gets institutionalized in the academy, as we build medical schools, as we build science programs, as we endow professorships in the sciences. In fact, the money is coming from the slave trade and from planters. And increasingly, in fact, the political will, the political interest of that class of people begin to get expressed through science.
And this is so important, I think. I wish, as I told you, I forgot the book, but inside of your, that I have it on the Kindle here. But on the margins of the book, I was writing all through this part of your book. One of the things that struck me about this was that, this is part of how the intellectual justification on race and racism was actually built by Americans, by what people who had become Americans in our universities and exported out. Right. It wasn't brought to us so much as it was exported out. And it also made me think about all the programs we've done on the kind of history of racism in medicine, and especially the experiments done on Native people and Black people in this country and poor people in America in general by colleges, which and until I read your book, I didn't – what snapped was I read your book was this is the historical root. This is the where the justification for these things, even if it wasn't conscious, came from to do these kinds of experiments on people in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah, you have these sort of incredible moments. But this is, in fact, the genesis of that relationship. It's the modern sciences, you know, the College of Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, Columbia Medical School, begin, in fact, with the transfer of the bodies of Black people to these new medical staffs, these students who are coming back from Europe and want to build medical programs. Right? They need corpses. And the colonial governments actually begin transferring corpses to them.
Black corpses.
Yeah, Black corpses. And the people who they prey upon are the marginalized people. It's the enslaved, the Black population, enslaved and free, actually, Native Americans, and occasionally the Irish. You know, and so it's actually the groups who you would actually expect to some extent in a colonial world. But this is certainly the genesis of that. This is the beginning of a relationship in which science preys upon the poor and the oppressed, and in the name of progress.
I think that one of the reasons I love your book so much is I think that it, if you read this book in as a historical context of who we are, to help us struggle and wrestle with what we do now.
Right.
If we understand where it came from, we can understand how maybe we can change where we are.
Right.
I mean, that's important of historians like you taking bringing that that world to us.
Yeah. You know, I mean, our job is actually to deliver new information and to hopefully influence the public debate, the public discourse, by giving the public more information than it had. And I think absolutely in the discussion about schools and the discussion about affirmative action and the discussion about higher education, the direction of the nation, we need more facts. We need a more intelligent debate. I'm not afraid of any of those debates. I just want them to be intelligent debates.
No, exactly. And another thing I was thinking about, I think it's important to put out here, and folks, I do encourage you to come meet Craig Stephen Wilder tonight at Red Emma's. You can go to redemma.org. I have that right, and get information about how you can get there. Just show up at 7:30 at the corner of Maryland Avenue and North Avenue. It's right there. Get your coffee, sit down, and take part in this conversation. It's redemmas.org. I do want to talk about Charles Follin. You talk about him there because there was opposition.
Mm-hmm.
There always is opposition, and it plays a critical role in what happens.
And I think it's important to remember that at every moment that I'm writing about, every period that I'm writing about in the book, there's opposition. There's opposition to slavery. There's opposition to the slave trade. There's a moral argument against all of these things that happens. And sometimes it's nuanced, and sometimes it's not, you know, it's not full-chested, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And Follin is actually an incredible figure. You know, Charles Follin is a radical German who gets chased out of Germany under threat of imprisonment for participating in radical movements, an academic. He eventually flees. He finds his way to Philadelphia. And then under somewhat really quite happenstance, he runs into the Marquis de Lafayette, who the United States has invited back for the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, General Lafayette, who had fought with the Americans.
Right, helped win the American Revolution. Right. Right, exactly.
He had fought with the Americans during the American Revolution, and now, 50 years later, after the Declaration, he's being brought back for this grand tour. Fallon actually runs into Lafayette in Philadelphia. And Lafayette decides to help him. And, what actually happens right there isn't clear. But the next step is he sends Fallon a note to his biographer up at Harvard, who's on the Harvard faculty. And Fallon gets appointed to a professorship in German. He proves quite popular with the students. You can actually follow. I followed his lecture notes. And so I actually, got to sit and just read through what he was saying to the students. But I also got to sit and see what the students were getting from it. And the relationship is about the same as it is today. it's a kind of fascinating thing to do. And I got to do it several times with 18th and 19th century and some 17th century faculty, both in Europe and the U.S. But Fallon actually, because of his own politics, gets attracted to the abolitionist movement. He becomes one of the leaders of the Massachusetts Abolitionist Society, eventually the New England Anti-Slavery Society, Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, and eventually gets punished by Harvard. They strip the money from his professorship in a meeting of the trustees. And George Tickner, the biographer of Fallon, who had actually helped to bring him there, resigns right after this. Fallon is forced to resign. Fallon goes to New York and I think with the help of a group of Unitarians, studies with his family for the Unitarian ministry and so, sort of puts his life back together. He's building a church in New England and he's supposed to go back to open the church. I think this is about 1840.
Right.
And on the ship that's carrying him back to New England, a load of cotton that's on deck is loaded too close to a steam pipe and it catches fire. And so slave-grown cotton being moved toward free New England on a ship carrying an abolitionist who's returning basically after Harvard's punishment. The ship catches fire. It burns for several hours, and then Fallon is killed. Virtually everyone on board is killed. You're left with this sort of story of what all this means. And I use it as the closing chapter of the book, in part because the relationship between cotton— it's the cotton that actually – Fallon's story is incredible, and it runs through several sections of the book.
Yeah.
But in this part of the book, I really wanted to focus on the cotton, the thing that causes the ship to catch fire. Because, in fact, actually, at the very moment that that ship is catching fire, slavery is largely gone from the northern states. But cotton is actually driving the northern economy. And it's certainly driving the internal politics of these colleges. Part of the reaction against Fallon's abolitionism is a reaction of the cotton textile merchants. It's the families with close ties earlier to slavery and now to cotton manufacturing in New England, whose money actually comes from slave-grown cotton in the South and, manufacturing it and exporting it to Europe. The northern economy is deeply invested in southern slavery long after slavery actually ends in the North.
It's like almost it's that story, the way you put it, when I said thinking about, again, as I was reading towards the end of the book where you talk about what happened with this the ship that went down, there's this poetic symmetry about it. I think that's what you're alluding to here.
That
I think is very powerful.
Well, and this is where MIT is, MIT is a product of this moment.
Right.
MIT is a product of the moment of, we, the cotton manufacturers of New England, need engineers to build these new cotton manufactories, these larger and larger cotton towns. And there's a scarcity of engineers, so they begin pumping money into engineering schools. Brooklyn Polytechnic, which gets the sugar money from Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where the big sugar refineries are, and MIT and many of the New England engineering schools, which will get money from the wealthy New England cotton manufacturers. But it's all, in fact, the products of slavery. Driving the northern economy.
Now, you see how fascinating Craig Stephen Wilder's stories are and how fascinating the book Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of American Universities is. It's an amazing book. I mean, Amazing book. You will read this book and you will do what I did, which is make just notes down every margin of every page because there's so much to think about. And then she said, the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.